This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start today with the state's opioid crisis. Last year, we broke records for the number of people who died from overdoses in the state. And the latest data out today showed deaths from opioids remain steady, with more than six people a day dying from overdoses related to the drugs. This is despite the state investing more than $1 billion since 2015 to fight this public health crisis. Leaders from the state's Department of Public Health are now endorsing a controversial tool, overdose prevention centers. They say these sites are needed to reduce the number of fatal overdoses. Still, monitoring illegal drug use is against the law unless the legislature enacts changes. But in private, some friends and family members already do this for loved ones. They just don't talk about it. WBUR's Martha Biebinger has the story of one mom named Renee, who's from the South, and her home-based overdose prevention project. And a warning, this story includes descriptions of intravenous drug use.
Renee pulls lawn chairs around a table in her backyard for an unusual gathering.
No, you're fine. I'm just letting you know that you...
Renee's first guest, Christina, drops a baggie on the table. Brownish powder clumped in one corner almost certainly includes fentanyl, a powerful opioid driving overdose deaths in Massachusetts and the U.S. to record highs. Christina scowls at an audio recorder next to her drugs.
Well, you know, does this show, like, anything?
This ain't about our faces. It ain't about who we are. It's about the lengths that we go through to keep each other safe and alive.
Today, that means Renee will monitor Christina's injection and revive her if needed. Renee has medical training. She knows CPR and rescue breathing. She has naloxone, the drug that can reverse an overdose, in one hand.
Got our Narcan here, you know, so if anything were to happen, we're ready.
Christina's hands shake as she lays out supplies. A needle, a lighter, and a tiny aluminum cooker. We're not using full names and have altered some voices because some of what the participants do could be illegal.
Where did that baggie go? I had a little bit in it.
I just laid it right there.
And that's all I got left.
I laid it right there, sir.
When the shot's ready, it's done in seconds.
But now I want her to sit here with me for a few minutes just to make sure she's...
I'm starting to sweat.
We can cut that fan on. Need you some water, get water.
If Christina took a lethal dose of fentanyl, it will knock her out fast. People who use drugs at Renee's do not have to worry about being raped or robbed if they lose consciousness. Today, Christina doesn't nod off.
All right, baby. I thank you.
After five or so minutes, Renee walks Christina to her ride.
I love you.
The two women hug.
This is seriously all it takes to keep somebody alive. People die of overdoses because they're by themselves.
Renee says she's reversed about 30 overdoses in her home-based supervised consumption or overdose prevention site. In Renee's home, there are some rules. Don't show up unannounced, never leave drugs behind, and people have to take turns.
I can't revive but one person at a time. I'm good, but I ain't that good.
The American Medical Association endorses clinics designed to prevent overdoses. But lawmakers, police, and prosecutors in some states are fighting these sites, saying they increase crime. Studies show this has not occurred at pilot clinics in the U.S. Opponents also argue that people with an addiction should be sent to treatment, not a place that enables drug use. Renee says people will use, safe space or not.
I enable them to leave of their own volition and not on an ambulance gurney or in a body bag. That's what I enable.
Many Americans would condemn what Renee does, and Renee would have condemned it too. But that was before her daughter started using drugs, and before Renee began the odyssey that now includes monitoring drug use. Roll back the clock about 10 years. Renee was a suburban mom, demanding that her teenage daughter stay in school, get a job, and stop seeing a boy Renee didn't like. Brooke responded by moving out. She got addicted to opioids. Renee often didn't know whether Brooke was dead or alive.
Thank you.
To tell their story, Renee drives past the cheap motels where she would occasionally see Brooke or run into someone with news about her only child.
This yellow one with the red writing on it right there. She stayed there a lot.
One day, after four frantic weeks of unanswered calls and texts, Renee spotted Brooke walking down the road. In that moment, something inside Renee flipped.
She was beautiful. She's my baby. And she was alive.
Her frustrations and ultimatums, all that energy spun toward a new goal, keeping Brooke alive.
And that's all that matters, you know?
It's a realization that will transform and upend Renee's life. For Brooke, the encounter was just annoying.
She was like, trying to get me to get in the car with her. I just wasn't having it. I was trying to go get some shit, you know?
Brooke says her goal was to get away, fast.
It was kind of like embarrassing when I saw her, because I know my mama, she don't care where she's at or who's around. She don't want, you know, get her point across.
The two argued and Brooke fled, but she left Renee with an opening. Brooke wanted Narcan, so Renee ordered lots of it and started dropping it off. She saw that Brooke looked reasonably healthy and not too thin, but her arms, where she would inject, were a mess.
Bruised and swollen and red. You know, I mean, obviously traumatized. Skin that was just had been traumatized.
Based on her medical training, Renee could tell that Brooke's sores and scabs were from reusing needles. Dirty, blunt tips leave wounds. Sharing needles can spread hepatitis C, HIV, and other viruses. Renee knew clean needles could improve her daughter's health. She also knew a needle she gave Brooke might deliver a fatal dose of fentanyl. Renee couldn't decide. What was the lesser of the two evils?
The swirl of emotions that I had was just insane. Am I enabling?
But over the next few months, Renee realized that Brooke didn't care if she had clean or dirty needles. She'd use whatever was around. The goal was to keep her daughter alive. Renee shelved her doubts and ordered syringes. When the box arrived, Renee drove to a trailer park where Brooke was staying.
Pulled up right here and she came out and met me.
It was a quick handoff. Brooke doesn't remember. She says she may have been high. Renee left in a panic, but she was too sick to drive. The debate kept pounding in her head.
What did you just do? Did you just make it easier for her? Did you just make it harder? Did you just give her permission?
But Renee's concerns faded as her daughter's sores healed. So Renee bought another box of needles. Possession of drug paraphernalia is illegal in many states. Renee didn't know that as she ordered more and more syringes and Narcan. It slowly dawned on Renee why Brooke was always out.
I'd give her stuff, but then she would give her stuff away.
And here, Renee had another revelation about what it would take to keep her daughter alive.
To help her meant I had to figure out how to help everybody else somehow.
At first, everyone else was just Brooke's friends. But soon, Brooke was running into strangers who had her mom's cell phone number.
People that don't even know me, you know what I'm saying? I'll meet them and they're like, your mama is, that's my mama. I mean, I love sharing her because not everybody's got a mama like I do, you know?
Renee was earning back Brooke's trust. But all these surrogate children would call day and night, demanding needles or Narcan. Renee couldn't keep up. She maxed out credit cards. Exasperated, Renee opened her laptop and searched for help.
There's got to be other people in the world doing this. How are you doing it and not losing your mind?
Renee discovered people across the country doing similar work that they called harm reduction. She joined organizations offering free or discounted needles, crack pipes, and Narcan. Today, Renee walks through a storage room at her home lined with crates and cabinets.
You know, and then we've got alcohol pads and cookers and tourniquets and all kinds of Narcan, thousands of Narcans that we go out with.
She stopped answering her phone at all hours, brought on volunteers, and created a regular delivery schedule.
We never deviated. I mean, we were doing it right.
But programs like the one Renee runs are illegal in parts of the U.S. Opponents say handing out needles enables drug use, addiction, and death. A few years ago, a woman who lost her son confronted Renee. The woman said Renee gave the young man the needle he used for that final shot. It was an upsetting conversation, but Renee says she is at peace with what she did.
It didn't break my heart that I gave him needles. It broke my heart that he was dead.
Renee doesn't know if this young man was alone when he died. Most people who aren't revived after an overdose are. Through Brooke, Renee is about to tackle that piece of the overdose crisis, too. Renee was making supper early one evening when she waded into the controversy surrounding supervised consumption for the first time. Brooke arrived unexpectedly and clearly in withdrawal. Renee watched Brooke pull a needle cooker, and small bag of powder out of her bag.
She kind of gathered up all of her stuff and started walking off towards the hallway bathroom. And immediately in my brain, I said no.
Because the bathroom Brooke headed for is small.
If she got in that bathroom and shut the door and fell out, overdosed, there's no way I'd be able to get that door open with her leaning against it. There's no way I would have been able to get to her.
So Renee did something she'd never done before. She asked Brooke to stay.
She was so sick. She was going to use carelessly. It took no time at all for my mind to process that whole situation and say, Brooke, you got to do this here, babe.
Renee remembers turning to face the kitchen sink so Brooke would have some privacy. Renee looked back when she heard soft sobs.
She had stuck herself unsuccessfully so many times that she had blood running down the back of her hand and dripping off of her fingertips onto the floor.
Renee helped her daughter clean up and calm down. Then Renee did something else she'd never done before. She sat with Brooke for the shot and waited until the danger of a fatal fentanyl overdose had passed. What has stayed with Brooke years later, when she's no longer injecting drugs, is the certainty in that moment that she was loved.
And she didn't, you know, judge me for what I was doing. She just wanted me to be all right. It was weird, though. I ain't gonna lie, it was weird.
Some parents would go way beyond weird and call what Renee did irresponsible or even criminal. Others are quietly doing something similar, an ear pressed against a bedroom or bathroom door, hoping they can intervene, if needed, before it's too late. Renee knows what worked for her to keep Brooke alive is not right for every family.
I hope I give them permission to love their loved one the way they see fit. There's no blueprint for this.
But for Renee, a blueprint did emerge that day for what would become her home-based overdose prevention project. It grew to include some of Brooke's friends, then people Renee met while distributing needles and Narcan.
You know what? Hey, you could. Where's your. Hey, little girl.
And these days, Renee's guests can also start treatment right here in her backyard.
You can get your car and pull it right back here.
The new arrival is a working mom we'll call A. Today, she just wants clean needles and Narcan. A tells Renee she's trying to wean herself off fentanyl, stretching the hours between injections and just using enough to prevent full withdrawal.
But if you're doing it, you're putting yourself at risk, and I'm fully aware of that every time I do it.
A says she wants to begin treatment with Suboxone, a drug that curbs cravings for fentanyl. But A's local treatment program told her she had to wait 72 hours between her last shot of fentanyl and starting Suboxone. A says she tried and decided she'd rather die.
You just think, we'll just get sick and get it over with. I don't know why. I don't know why it's so hard.
Renee listens as A starts to cry. Then Renee describes another way to start Suboxone. It's called microdosing and is used at many medical centers. As soon as A can no longer tolerate the fentanyl withdrawal, she'll take a small dose of Suboxone and slowly transition to the new drug. Renee says she's done this for half a dozen people, even though she is not licensed to prescribe Suboxone.
So people like me have to break the law. We have to risk everything to be able to help people like her.
Sometime soon, Renee will find a way to get Suboxone for A. Renee wants to have it in hand when A calls, because the window of opportunity between a last shot, the decision to start treatment, and withdrawal might be just a few hours.
All she's got to do now is look at me and say, I'm ready. That's the end of the conversation.
A wipes her face as she weighs Renee's offer. She says she isn't ready yet, but is close. What matters to A in this moment is knowing that Renee will do whatever she can to help.
It does give me hope. You know, it gives me hope that she hasn't given up on me. It's just maybe hard to believe that I'm worth that.
This is the core of Renee's work, building relationships that help restore her clients' self-respect and dignity. It happens in the hug after a needle delivery, the attention to someone who's injecting, the rescue breaths that bring them back to life, and the door Renee opens to treatment. A says lots of people offer to help with conditions. But with Renee, A says there are no expectations or judgment, just kindness.
I think if there was more of that, it's, I can't imagine how different things could be.
So three kits, 12 bags. 12, yeah. And can we put them all in the same bag?
Yeah.
Put them all in the same bag, bye.
After A collects her supplies, Renee reviews the week ahead. She may have to cancel deliveries. An agency that was supposed to send needles isn't coming through, and she's broke. Brooke says many people don't appreciate the risks her mom takes to do this work in crime-ridden neighborhoods where people may be desperate for money.
I worry about her more than she knows, actually, because, like, you don't have to do anything that she's doing.
Renee says she'd love to stop. Many days it's hard to get out of bed and face the news of another death. But there's happiness, too. Brooke, after four rounds of rehab, says she's not using opioids. Renee shakes her head.
You know, surviving her will be the hardest thing I've ever done. Surviving her will also be the greatest adventure I'll ever have.
And if there's a line Renee isn't willing to cross to keep Brooke and the 200-plus people she serves every week alive, Renee says she hasn't found it yet. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Martha Biebinger.
Paul Kahlo mixed that story, and Martha's here with us now in Studio 2. Martha, thanks for coming.
Glad to be here.
So you were listening with me to your reporting. Any reactions now to hearing it?
Well, of course, I think about all the stuff that got left on the cutting room floor, so to speak. You know, so many good quotes. There was one that I really tried to wedge in there. Renee says at one point, she said, drugs are the weapon that shame uses to kill people. She just will come out with these things every now and then. Drugs are the weapon that shame uses to kill people. And I thought, wow, you know, we spend billions of dollars investigating fentanyl, arresting people, putting them in prison for a long time, traffickers. And I get that. I get the need to do all of that. But most people who overdose are alone when they die. And we're not spending billions on the shame that keeps them behind closed doors because they're too embarrassed to show people that they're using. So I just wonder about our priorities sometimes.
So how did you find Renee and her family, Martha?
Good old-fashioned reporting. I just talked to lots of people. I had been in touch with several moms in Massachusetts who were doing this on a much smaller scale, just the overdose prevention part, in their homes, you know, instead of their child being behind a closed door in a bathroom or bedroom, they would do it openly and help make sure that they could revive them if they needed to. But for various reasons, those stories didn't work out, the timing and other things. So eventually someone said, well, you know, I think this woman named Renee does this. Why don't you call her? And it was over a course of a couple of years chatting with her and kind of building that relationship. And then we fell out of touch for a while. Oftentimes when mothers or parents of children stop calling me back, I don't push because I don't know whether the child, something happened. So it was about 6 months, and then somebody said, nah, she's fine, call her again. So a lot of back and forth.
But there were Massachusetts stories you wish you could have told.
Yes. I mean, there's so many varieties of this, Tiziana. As I said, that there were a couple of moms, one in Western Mass and one down more towards the Taunton area, who have done this with children over the years. And they each have such interesting dynamics because sometimes there's just one parent who's willing to do this. Sometimes the child is willing to use with a parent or with a sibling, but they don't tell anybody else. A lot of times this happens with alcohol because people decide they want their loved one to drink in the home and not risk passing out on the street or in some other dangerous place. So there's a lot of variation, and there are a lot of stories that would have been great to tell, but this is the one that worked.
You know, this is every part of the story is gut-wrenching, and you talk multiple times about all of the risks involved here. Did it worry you to report this for yourself, for the people whose stories you were telling here?
Not really for myself. You know, NPR, this is a partnership with NPR, and they have a safety person. So there were several meetings about what I could and couldn't do, you know, what my emergency evacuation plan would be, this and that. But I did worry a lot for Renee because she, having a reporter trail her in and out of, you know, she works with a lot of dealers. She distributes to a lot of dealers. She's built relationships with people who used to think she was a narc for the police. And And so to bring another stranger in and somebody with a recorder, she really had to massage a lot of relationships to make that happen. And I worried about the effect on her and her team as well. And of course, a lot of what she does is probably illegal. And so we had a lot of agreements, everything kind of laid out in advance. But we had to be sure that I could tell a story and she could feel comfortable sharing. It was hard to find that middle ground.
We're here with WBUR's Martha Biebinger talking about a story she's reported we just played about a family impacted by the opioid epidemic and a mother who runs a drug consumption site out of her home. When I was listening, Martha, I thought, I know how much you know. And yet I know you learned things you didn't know doing this. What did you learn?
You know, I learned a lot about reporting on the opioid epidemic, of course, but I thought so much about all the mistakes that I've made as a parent, you know, trying to force my kids to do the right things and prioritize things that I thought were important. And Renee doesn't have any of those expectations for her participants. You know, she just wants them to be her best selves. And if I could go back and just do that for all of my three kids, man, I would love to take back that time. And then on a physical level, Tiziana, I'm going to talk about something that's going to be difficult for you, I think, because you're about as needle phobic as I am.
It's true.
There was a point in an interview when Renee, she just opened a pack of syringes and she pulled a needle out and she opened her arm, you know, picture laying your arm out to give blood. She swabbed a spot and she just stuck the needle in, right into the vein. You saw a little blood come out. And it was me and one of her participants sitting there and we just both started freaking out. We're like, what are you doing? It's gross. And she said, so picture how your kid would feel if you did that while they were using drugs. Imagine the shame that they would feel if you reacted that way. This is why we need overdose prevention sites, because we need people to be able to deal with their addiction in a way that they feel supported and comfortable.
Martha, I want you to hear me. I don't think there's anybody who listened to this story who didn't find themselves thinking about someone they love.
Yeah.
And whether and how they wanted to rise to the occasion. I want you to know I connected.
Yeah,
that same way. What's
Thank
next?
You.
Yeah. What's next? What stories come out of this reporting for you? Where do you go next for yourself with this?
Well, I'll tell you, maybe I'll answer that, Tiziana, by telling you the stories that I don't think I can tell just yet. Because in the spectrum of harm reduction that starts with having Narcan available, goes to offering people needles so that they can use as safely as possible, continues to monitoring their drug use. Another thing that we don't do is help people understand how to inject safely. A lot of us don't understand how the veins work in our body. So should we have trainings for people who are using drugs to show them how that they can use so they're not injecting into their heads or necks, the pictures you see that they can cause stroke, they can cause brain damage. There's also a lot of talk about safer drug supply. So there are people who are trying to work with dealers so that they're adding less crap, even though it's all really quite dangerous stuff.
I mean, we've learned about fentanyl and xylazine from you before here on Radio Boston.
Exactly. So I'm not sure that people are ready to talk about those things, and I'm not sure the public's ready to hear them, but that's kind of an area that I'm exploring.
WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger, we'll explore with you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston.